This is Boston Public Radio. Could the baby boomers actually be the greatest generation? That group of self-absorbed experimental drug users who are draining Social Security? P.J. O'Rourke joins us to make the case that they are. It's the subject of his new book, The Baby Boom. From there, we talk about a woman who preceded the boomers, Gloria Steinem. She turns 80 this year. Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us to discuss Steinem's legacy and how she continues to change the world.
From there, behavioral economist Michael Norton stops by with new insight into the grieving process. It turns out small rituals can help us integrate the mourning process into our everyday lives. Then Bob Mankoff, the New Yorker cartoon editor, drops by to talk about the craft of cartooning and how he's rejected submissions from the likes of Norman Mailer and David Mamet. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Today, we're replaying a broadcast of some of our favorite conversations. We're kicking things off with writer and humorist P.J. O'Rourke, who dropped by earlier this year to talk about his new book. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. So here's a pop quiz for you. One, who came to power in 1978 when the film Animal House hit the big screen? Two, who is known for profligate use of illegal intoxicants? And three, who is responsible for bringing down the Berlin Wall? According to P.J. O'Rourke, that if you were born between 46 and 64, in other words, it's the boomers. And the boomers are the subject of his latest terrific book, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way and Why It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. P.J. O'Rourke, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, it's great to meet you guys in person. I've been listening forever.
Oh,
we love that.
You've made our day.
Yeah.
You've absolutely made our day.
But now
day.
We have to be nice. That's the only unfortunate part, but we'll...
Well, I'm an old NPR hand. You know, I can do nice.
Okay,
you know,
fine.
You know,
okay.
It's nice, actually.
It is nice.
Being nice.
Okay, you have written a very, very funny book, and I'm going to read you the first sentence from the prologue, We Are the World. We, meaning the boomers, are the generation that changed everything. Of all the eras and epochs of Americans, ours is the one that made the biggest impression on ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
But we have done some good things. Tell us some of the best and worst of what the baby boomers have done. We have done a lot of good things. Jim just mentioned a couple of them.
Actually, I think it's mostly a net plus, as long as, of course, you're not younger than the baby boom and have to pay for us. Because we have every intention of living. I mean, first we were never going to get old. Now we're never going to die.
That's, you know, right.
And you're gonna, and then poor Generation X that comes along next, which is in the baby bus, they're gonna pay through the nose for this. So that's the bad side. But it wasn't our fault. Nothing was ever our fault.
Ever.
Roosevelt passed that Social Security, as Lyndon Johnson did Medicare. The good side of it is that you'll notice that wars have been scaled down incredibly since the baby boom took power. I say 78 is when they took power because of the very last. As they roll the credits in Animal House, you see Senator Blutarsky. And if you go to Washington today, he's there. He's there. He's there. He's everywhere. And, you know, we're a self-centered generation, but we're a very kind and loving generation, too. We want to be loved. We want to love other people in all senses of the word, sometimes in the wrong senses of the word. But you know what we mean. We want to give the world a hug and a drug. And, you know, and so just to take war, for instance, the prior generations, you get World War I, World War II, the Korean War, you know. And indeed, the Vietnam War. Baby boom wasn't in on starting that. We were in on getting out of it. And then it comes time for the baby boom. Yeah, we still have a lot of wars, but they're all like sort of Crimea-sized, mm-hmm. You know? I mean, and, you know, what's the death toll now in the Crimean War?
I think it's one.
One,
yeah,
I think. Yeah,
one.
Yeah, it's one. Now, that's one too many.
We're not saying it's a good thing,
no,
but it is one
too many. No, we're not praising it, but... But one is better than 20 million.
But, you know, you use the term, I know you're not crazy about it, generalizations, and you can't make them. I mean, I was thinking about politics today because you've written brilliantly about politics through the years. On one hand, the baby boomer in chief is clearly Bill Clinton. Can we agree?
Absolutely. He just in every way, shape, and form.
Okay,
I didn't inhale.
Exactly. The most brilliant triangulator ever to get things done.
Yeah.
But then the flip side is you have baby boomers in absolute and total gridlock in Washington, sort of the opposite of Bill Clinton, where nothing gets done.
Well, it's an interesting thing about the baby boom. You would expect, as I was writing this book, I expected to sort of figure out the politics of the baby boom, and I couldn't. And if you take, you know, we've had three boomer presidents now. We've got one. We've had two before. We had Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and we've got President Obama. Now, if you map those three guys out politically, you have to go to Pyongyang to find somebody who is more different from them than they are from each other. They totally cover the map. And there is no baby boom politics. But we do love to argue and yell at each other. And, of course, that's Washington. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of – now, mind you, there's some good things to be said for gridlock. Was Germany in political gridlock when they marched into Poland in 1939? No. Was Japan in political gridlock when it bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941? No. Closer to home, Tonkin Gulf resolution gave LBJ a free hand to do whatever he wanted.
Virtually unanimously, right?
There were two votes against it in the Senate and none.
None in the House.
None
right.
in the House. So let's, before we lament gridlock too much.
Gridlock is one of the great things the baby boomers have given us.
It may be because we don't know what this government might be up to if it weren't in gridlock.
You know, I was just thinking, I'm sure someone else has suggested this. As I'm thinking about the baby boomers, you should be debating Tom Brokaw, assuming he's in good health. He does the greatest generation. You do the baby boomers.
You know,
how great would that be?
Tom and I were actually talking about this.
Were you really?
Yeah, I mean, we were. Yeah, I know him a little bit. In fact, I just got the nicest note from him. I wrote to him saying, you know, please get a more spellable disease. and hope everything's going
horrible.
Well. Well, no. I mean, he's, you know, I know him well enough to say. And he admitted that they do need to come up with something snappier to call what he's got. I think he's doing okay. Apparently they can maintain, you can't cure what he's got, but you can
chronic.
You can go to chronic.
Yeah, chronic.
So you're going to debate each other? What's the bottom line?
Well, that's what, we were kind of talking about this before he got sick. It'd be a great, something to do at the New York Public Library or something. Not debate, really, but just have the greatest versus the not-so-hot-so.
One of your funny lines about the greatest generation, talking about how the baby boomers, of course, we all have our GPSs now, and the greatest generation was lost all the time.
They were lost all the time.
And it's so true. How many times did you have to fight in the car with your parents when mom wanted to stop for directions and dad said, oh, no.
Why that is? I have a whole theory about men not stopping for directions.
You do?
See, when men travel by themselves, and, you know, we're going back here to early primate humans.
That's right.
When men were traveling by themselves, what they were doing was stealing and killing and ravaging and pillaging and things like that. Now, you don't ask directions when you're out ravaging and pillaging, because do people tell you the truth?
It's true.
So where's your treasure and women? Oh, now go down here, take a left, take another left, and then you'll see this roundabout. But women, when women and men were traveling together, they were migrating. And so women are working on building social networks.
I like that.
And, you know, women knew where they were going anyway, someplace warm, you know, where there's more food and fewer mastodons. But they were just asking to make friends along the way. And they said, do you know where the nearest,
I think that makes sense.
Ditch full of water is or something.
Are you like me whenever you drive alone now in 2014, you just wear a loincloth? Is that how I am most comfortable doing that. Are you as well? I've had a feeling you were.
Well, so let's get back to the baby boom. We're talking with PJ O'Rourke, whose new book is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. You did talk about, and I think this is one of the little feathers in our caps, because we're all baby boomers in this room, the tolerance thing, the women's rights, the gay rights, the civil rights. That was partly.
You know, we didn't invent that stuff, of course. There's
we did not invent it.
Tendency for baby boomers to take credit for all those things.
But I would look, like to.
You know, civil rights like that began with like, oh, the Civil War. You know, that fight has been going on since back then. Women's liberation. Gloria Steinem was born in the 30s.
She 80 and I years old.
80 years old. I can't believe it.
She and I happened to come from the same hometown.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you'd think when she and I get together, we'd argue politics, but we talk about Toledo. I'm coming
wow.
from Toledo, Ohio, and so does she. And, even gay rights really predates the Stonewall riots and
sure.
so on. Those probably weren't baby boomers. So we have a tendency to take credit for that. But what we did do was internalize it. That is to say, we didn't care. She's hot. So who cares whether she's Jewish or from outer space or, it just didn't matter. And, so the baby boomers, and that stuck in our society. I had the greatest, I love to tell this story about I've got a 13-year-old daughter. And when she was about 10, she came home from school. And they'd been talking about adoption, and she was a little confused about it. And so we explained adoption to her. And we said, you have friends that are adopted. She said, I do, yeah. She said, you've got this friend, Mary. Mary was adopted as a baby from Ethiopia. Well, Mary's parents are German-Irish. You know, they're about 5'4 and pink and freckled, you know. And Mary is this beautiful, Ethiopian.
Statuesque.
She's in her teens now. She's already like 6'1". And she's just absolutely gorgeous, runway model gorgeous. And ebony, just beautiful ebony color. And Olivia, my daughter, like looks at us and says, I thought Bet looked a little different.
It's good she has you there to explain it to her.
Yeah, it was a good thing. So, that kind of thing just could not have happened 50 years
no.
ago. Could never, ever have happened 50 years
no,
ago.
No, it absolutely could not.
Speaking of what couldn't happen 50 years ago, and we're talking to P.J. O'Rourke, whose latest book is about the most powerful, biggest consuming generation has ever lived. Like 50% of the consumer power of the United States is in the baby boomers.
It would have to be if you figure. I mean, I'm not in my peak earning years, but lots of us are. 50 to 60 some, whatever the oldest baby boomers are, that's your peak earning period. It's also your peak spending period because not on little stuff, not on clothes and things, but on stuff like houses, vacation homes. Midlife crisis, sports cars, we got all that. We do all the big ticket shopping. And we have every intention of using up all the money before we go.
Well, that's an interesting question. That's a perfect segue as to what are we going to leave after we've created the perfect generation, the baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to leave other than debt? And what are we leaving
debt
those
and
after us?
Yeah. I've always found the generation that comes right after us, the Generation X, to be kind of a mopey bunch. I think part of it was that, every kid has got to rebel. I mean, everybody, this has been going on since Roman times. Oh, those kids today, they're wearing their togas too short. Every generation of kids has got to be rebellious. It's got to shock its elders. And when Generation X came along, we used up all the weird. The baby boom had just used up all the weird. Weird hair, we wore it. Weird beards, we grew them. Weird words, we said them. Weird thoughts, we had them. Weird things, we did them. Weird stuff, we smoked it. And they were just, how are they going to go through that natural adolescent phase where you shock the grown-ups? And they had to get like these piercings and all these tattoos, and that must have hurt. I apologize. Ouch.
It's interesting, though, the baby boomers who did do the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, we weren't particularly tolerant of our children doing the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We became sort of puritanical for
we are the helicopter parents. Charles Krauthammer has a great line about this. I've been stealing from him. Finally, somebody told me who had said it first, so now I have to credit Charles. It was a great guy, incidentally. But Charles said baby boomers were helicopter parents. He said, our parents, greatest generation, they were drone parents.
That is a great line.
Farther away, not too involved, and every now and then, whack.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. You know, we talked with PJ O'Rourke, and the name of the new book is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. One of the sections that really resonated with me was talking about the baby boomers as kids. You know, when you talk about the cliche, but it was really true. Come home when the streetlights go on.
Right.
What do we do all
our childhood?
Get out of
the house when it's a nice day.
Yeah,
nice day being very loosely defined.
Yeah, and we did nothing. We just did nothing.
Yeah,
we played jacks
around.
And marbles and jump rope. I think my kids have no idea what jacks and marbles and jump rope are.
No, I don't. Well, there's an app for that.
Oh, there is.
Know.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, they're playing all this stuff, you know, on their phones. But we are the one – oh, back to the helicopter parents thing for 1 minute is that one of the reasons that we're so cautious and so puritanical and overprotective of our children is because we look at kids – we've stayed kids. And so when we look at kids, we know what they're thinking. Our parents had no idea what we were thinking. We know what the kids are thinking. Plus – we did all that John Belushi stuff, and for some of us, we all have friends that it turned out in a John Belushi way.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, we sex, drugs, and rock and roll, it's all fun and games till the bong sets fire to the beanbag chair. You know, and then you're out of luck. But back to the, I don't know, what we were talking about something when I interrupted myself.
The free range.
Oh, kids.
We did nothing as children.
The other thing that we had going for us, and nobody's ever, ever, ever going to have this again, is this unitary existence as a generation. There were only three television stations at the most. When we got our first TV in 1950, there was one television station in Toledo. So we all saw the same stuff on television. There were only like there were three AM radio stations all playing the same songs. The America was a much more uniform place. And at first when I was writing about this, I thought, oh, well, PJ, that's because you grew up. I did. I looked up our family income, and we were smack on the median. Half of the families in America were poorer than we were. Half were richer. I come from the middle of America. I come from, like, Toledo, Ohio. So middle class, middle American. Or, you know, I'm so ordinary, I thought there must be, like, lots of, like, outliers. But the more I talked to people, I thought even if they were much richer than me, if they grew up much richer than me or they grew up much poorer, they shared the same experience. Now we've got all these little micro societies. And if you happen to be a boy that likes putting doll clothes on your Legos, you know, now you would have kept that to yourself in my day because you would have spent a lot of time in your locker at junior high. But now you can get on the web and find out that there are other boys with doll clothes and Legos, you know, and you.
So what's the consequence of that? I mean, so that there are all these subsets.
You know, we don't know.
Of kiddom now.
We don't know. We're in a kind of experiment. It's too early to tell what that's going to be.
Hey,
like.
Speaking of too early to tell, PJ O'Rourke, you have your analysis of what the boomer generation is in 2014. It's 2114. And people are looking back on what were called baby boomers a century before. How are they going to view us differently from how you see us today?
I think they're going to see the plus side more. I think short term, the baby boom is going to be reviled. And we're going to be reviled for essentially the reasons that sex, drugs, and rock and roll, unleashing sex, drugs, and rock and roll on the world. And one of the other bad things that we did was, like, we made marriage disappear. Poof. You know, what's it like? 110% of kids are now born out of wedlock in the United States or something like that. And I never was good with statistics. So there are lots of – and we're using up all the money. And so the immediate post-baby boom period is going to look back and down at us. 100 years hence, I think they're going to look back at this, like, sea change that the world underwent while the baby boom was in charge, where all of a sudden, like, there are millions, billions of people able to feed themselves that weren't. I mean, the global wealth, it's, you know, comparative, but global wealth in places like India and China, it's just changed radically while we've been around. I mean, the number of people, you know, starvation rarely, only under political circumstances do you come across starvation anymore. Not because of economic circumstances. People all over the world are becoming middle class, and I think they'll look back at us as the watershed for that. And so we're going to have a good rep in 100 years.
Yeah, but let's say in 2114 for a second. How do you think the average American is going to react to the fact that by then, let me do the math, it'll be 101 years that healthcare.gov is not working? Do you think that's going to be, is that going to be a problem?
I'm still waiting to enroll. Yeah. We're not going to be remembered for our brilliant political finesse, you know, and we're not going to be praised for we didn't really set off the big social program entitlement world, political world. I mean, that started after World War II all sure. over everywhere, but we didn't come to grips with it. You know, I mean, I'm a moderately well-off guy. There's no reason why I should be getting the same deal at Medicare. I'm on Medicare now. You don't have a choice about being on that. You turn 65.
You're on it.
It's like the AARP. You don't have a choice about belonging to that. You know?
It's down.
That's how Osama got killed, you know. I mean, he turned 50. AARP tracked him down. Shared
down.
The info. You know, we didn't come to grips with this. You know, I shouldn't be paying the same amount as some broke homeless guy, you know, who's also over 65.
And you shouldn't be getting the same amount, right?
When it comes to something like Social Security, yeah, probably. I mean, all these programs need to be in one way or another means tested.
I love that I'm agreeing with
especially,
P.J. O'Rourke.
Well, I know that things are always really – when things are really politically screwed up, I know it because I start to agree with Jim.
P.J. O'Rourke's new book is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. Up next, Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us to talk about someone who beat the boomer generation by about 10 years. That would be Gloria Steinem. She turns 80 this year. How she has changed and is still changing the world is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I've done a lot of work on ex-offenders and recidivism.
Rupa Shenoy is WGBH's investigative reporter.
I think it's a problem that no one looks at. I mean, most people go back to jail within 3 years of leaving jail. And we have a whole population that's just caught in a cycle, and it catches their children, and it catches their families, and no one looks at it.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, now a partner with WGBH News.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the trustees of reservations, preserving for public use and enjoyment more than 100 of Massachusetts' special places, like the Crane Estate in Ipswich. More information at thetrustees.org. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, bringing diverse people to Boston. The series returns to Symphony Hall next season with Dan Rather, Madeline Albright, Ken Burns, and others. BostonSpeakerSeries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, today we're replaying some of our favorite conversations. This year, Gloria Steinem turns 80. Harvard historian Nancy Kane joined us to take stock of Steinem's life thus far and how she continues to fight for women's rights. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Gloria Steinem turned 40. She publicly announced, quote, "This is what 40 looks like." Today, 40 years later, we're taking stock of what 80 looks like for Gloria Steinem. Joining us for her take on Gloria Steinem, the 80-year-old Gloria Steinem's legacy, which is still in the making, is Nancy Kane. Nancy, as you know, is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Nancy's latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey, Nancy.
Hey.
Welcome back.
Hey, great to be here.
Well, you know, one of the questions we did want to ask you about today is who's going to pick up the mantle, if anybody is. But before we get to that, why are we all so, and I am too, and I'm sure you are, so attached and enamored to Gloria Steinem? What was it about her? Or is it? She's still here, obviously.
A couple of things. I mean, I think she became rightfully, in many ways, became an enormously important symbol of a whole lot of change. It wasn't just change for women. I mean, we think of Gloria Steinem as, you know, standing on the streets or standing in, you know, in Ms. Magazine or a convention of the National Organization of Women as the face of second wave feminism. But really, you know, she wasn't agitating solely for rights for women. She was agitating for a new conceptions of what, you know, an anthropologist would call gender roles, but new roles and possibilities for both men and women. One of the most poignant of her many, many, you know, empathic and intelligent and savvy, you know, speeches and writings was a testimony she gave for the Equal Rights Amendment back in the very early 70s before Congress. And she spent half the time talking about what the Equal Rights Amendment meant for men. So it wasn't just about women get more power, men get less. It was never about that. It was always about what does it mean to be a fuller human being with equal rights and privileges and possibilities, regardless of whether you were born with an XY chromosome or two X chromosomes. So I think that's a piece of it. Her, you know, the kind of large-heartedness and breadth of what she was talking about very early on. I think, you know, another part of our attraction to her, particularly people of my age, right, of, you know, sort of the last of the boomers and older. I've just taught her as part of my leadership course two weeks ago to my students, and many of them did not know much about her, particularly the men. And it was so interesting to listen to what they had to say and to watch them discovering her. I think there's a third. There's a second piece to what we besides the, you know, symbol of feminism, and I think that's partly about a woman who's done so many different things. So her career is not the well scripted, carefully kind of manicured, straightforward path of a lot of different leaders. You know, she's not like Lincoln, who always wanted to be a successful politician. She's not like Barack Obama. She's not like, you know, some great business leaders. She is someone who navigated point to point, right? Starting with her early writing career and then getting interested in women's rights and then getting interested in Cesar Chavez and migrant workers' rights. And now she's very interested in a whole variety of different issues about human rights around the world.
She's spending her 80th birthday in Botswana.
In Botswana, riding elephants.
Which is today, by the way.
Right, exactly. She said, I hope my funeral is a fundraiser for a worthy cause. So here's someone for whom the revolution never dies. The spirit is strong. And her, you know, in some sense, the siren song of her life has been about where does change need to happen and what can I do? Not so much from the top down, although she's clearly had lots of relationships with very, very powerful people, right? But how can I make change happen from the bottom up? So I think the consistency of the vision and the dedication to goodness and social progress, I think, is palpable. And we hunger for it in this age, particularly when we seem so starved for leaders of worthy values and significant commitment on the public stage.
You know, Gail Collins, former editorial page editor of the New York Times,
love
and now
her.
A columnist there, so do I. What was the thing that you most stood out during the last presidential campaign? Do you remember what she did? Every time she wrote about a particular subject, every time she mentioned Mitt Romney, every time she mentioned him in a column, she mentioned the dog on the top of the roof. She writes, she's the face of feminism, about Gloria Steinem. She says something, and when I was reading, I was worried she wasn't going to say this, because this is pretty clearly true to me, too. There are two reasons, writes Collins, that Steinem turned out to be the image of the women's liberation movement. One did indeed have to do with their spectacular physical appearance. And while the Washington Post columnist Maxine Cheshire, she quotes, says, once said, the mini-skirted pinup girl of the intelligentsia, the reason she had such great appeal to the vast swath of mainstream America, why they let her in, for lack of a better expression, that was the door opener, wasn't it? I know a lot of people don't like to say it. Wasn't that a big piece
of this? Oh, I think it's very important. I teach her with Estee Lauder, and I start off saying, look, let's start with the fact that both these women were drop-dead gorgeous.
Stunning.
And,
totally.
And use their beauty, right, as part of their mission, to accomplish their mission. Absolutely. And yet, she says today, you know, I don't begrudge anyone having Botox or facelifts, but I chose not to do that. I color my hair.
Color hair, right.
I color my hair. I just saw a picture of her. She looks awful good.
She does.
She
looks
wonderful.
Terrific.
So tell us more about your class. If we hadn't been there in this leadership class where you're teaching Gloria Steinem, what are the two or three most salient things you said about her as leader?
I'm not sure it was what I said. It was what the students
said. Well, let's hear that.
So I'll never forget one of my very, very intelligent, very, you know, very kind of trenchant second-year MBA students from the financial, a series of financial sector jobs, saying, I'm so impressed by her because of the empathy, both the empathy that she could display person by person, more on that in a second, but also the way that she could connect with all these groups. Because she begins the feminist, you know, kind of change process kind of church basement by church basement in the 60s, traveling with people like Dorothy Freeland, other activists, and meeting with groups of men and increasingly women in small groups. And she was terrified of public speaking. She writes about this in one of her early books called Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, how scared she was of speaking. And he said, I'm so struck by her commitment to teach herself how to be a good public speaker, then to use her powers of empathy and connection and kindness with a hard-hitting message that she never really let up on, and how she could both, in a sense, bring people from all kinds of different walks of life, from, you know, the powerful editors and journalists and other people that became part of her village, to the men that she dated that were very, very prominent.
And Mort Zuckerman.
Mort Zuckerman. She married David Bale, the father of Christian Bale, right? The only marriage.
Well, I didn't know that.
She married
father
David Bale.
Of Christian Bale.
She married him later in his life. He actually very shortly thereafter was diagnosed with brain cancer, and she nursed him through it.
Yeah.
Nursed him through the end of his life. And so he said, I'm so struck by the combination of empathy, generosity, strategic insight, and her willingness to be made herself and to reinvent herself as needed as she went. And, you know, to me, he said, she's one of the most impressive leaders in the class because of that, because he didn't lose sight of the big picture. Right. But she also wasn't afraid to deal with all the obstacles in her path as she walked toward that big mission.
And you know what else strikes me about Gloria Steinem is that many, maybe this is unfair, but male leaders that I think of as big time leaders, she did not have their kind of ego. She was quite, I keep saying she was. She is. She is a extremely humble person.
Tell the story about calling her on the phone.
Oh, yes. Well, my daughter read her biography when she was a little girl. And
when your daughter was a little girl.
My daughter was a little girl, that's right. And I got her number, and I called. I'm not sure if I called first to ask or if my daughter called herself. But in any case, Gloria Steinem gave my little girl, who was then about 10 years old, like a 20-minute interview for a paper she was doing in school. So I helped her with it.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, this is like a little 10-year-old kid.
So, you know, Gail Collins refers to this, and I want to mention one other thing about this. I think this is incredibly important. So the willingness to make and make human contact with all kinds of people, right? So she never lives in the ether of great, you know, fame and wealth. She never stays in that bubble, right? So there's a wonderful story in the Gail Collins column from the Sunday Times about a friend, a journalist, traveling with her to India recently. And, you know, Gloria just won't stop shaking people's hands and speaking with them. And the journalist says, I'm exhausted. Why are you doing this? She says, how can I not do it? I may never meet this person again. It's my only chance to, you know, to kind of respond to their outreach and have contact with them. You know, I'm sure she felt the same way when she talked to your daughter. Let me read you something from her memories. It's very brief. And this is about her memories of the early years of organizing and all those church basements and all those people that criticized her and threw things at her. And this is one of the, you know, she has these wonderful little vignettes of what she remembers from that moment. And here's one that I never forget. And these are the good sides. She has all the bad sides, too. She has just a series of recollections.
From the same book you mentioned.
From the same book. I'm sorry. Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions. Okay. This is the first chapter. And this is her memory. Sitting in an ethnic hall in Detroit at a celebration of Ms. Magazine's 10th birthday. So that's roughly 1981. And being tapped on the shoulder by a small, gray-haired woman with gnarled, hardworking hands and a starched cotton house dress that is clearly her best. I actually can remember my mother wore house dresses. And she goes on, I just wanted you to know, the woman with the house dress says softly, that you are inside of me. All reward comes together, Steinem goes on, in that one moment. Remembering now her touch and words, I can still feel the tears behind my
eyes.
Takes
your breath away, doesn't it? It is great.
I mean, again, the poignancy and the respect for each of these moments with these different people. And we hunger for that today in our lives and in our leaders.
We have a little piece of her talking about being multi-orgasmic until dawn, which is the exact same phrase she used at Smith College commencement. Let's hear, which this is when she's talking about the idea that women can have it all. It's simply impossible. Here's Gloria Steinem.
The idea that you have to do it all to have it all was two things. It's a culture that didn't want to change. And therefore said you can't be a lawyer or a TV interviewer or whatever it was you wanted to be. And then when we did it anyway, said, okay, providing you do everything you did before, you have to cook three meals, you have to, you know, be the perfect housekeeper, you have to be multi-orgasmic till dawn, what, you know, sort of makes you tired just to think about it. Because society didn't want to change.
I love her voice, too.
I do love her voice.
Great.
I absolutely do love her voice.
You know, one of the things is a lot has been written about Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. A lot has been written about Gloria Steinem as she hits 80 today. And one of the things that virtually everybody who writes about her asks, which is a fairly obvious question, is why isn't there a Gloria Steinem today? And when I read that, I say to myself, well, why isn't there a Martin Luther King today? I mean, there are certain people who were extraordinary at the moment that needed them.
Yeah.
And one of the points that one of the people we read this morning makes is so much was achieved in the big picture in Steinem's prime that there are now a million little battles,
absolutely,
which don't really fit the notion of one person,
yeah,
or one set of people. Do you buy that notion?
I do. I mean, remember that when she was writing freelance pieces and, you know, disguising herself as a Playboy bunny, she did this,
yeah,
and wrote,
yes,
and wrote about it,
yeah,
right, when she, in the early 1960s. Remember, there was no Title IX, right? There was no anything like the Equal Rights Amendment. Abortions were illegal, right, and they were dangerous.
Abortions were legal. That's a very good point.
Right, and they were dangerous to undertake, and yet women did that anyway, right? Ward and June Cleaver were the idea of an archetype of a kind of family and a proper marriage, and, you know, his pipe and slippers came to him, you know, when he walked in the door, right, and she delivered them. And it was a completely different world. I mean, my students, men and women, who are greatly changed from the students I taught when I first arrived at Harvard Business School in 1991 and 1992. So when I got there, it was like four men to every woman, right? And now we're getting close to half and half. And the men were completely different. They didn't talk about, well, I'm not sure I can take a consulting job because I'm going to want to have a family and help raise my children myself. I mean, this world has changed so much.
Yeah.
And she was there at the revolution. Right at the kind of big picture, kind of breaking of the old tectonic plates that really fashion. I mean, there is no Sheryl Sandberg, right? There is no Arianna Huffington, who has a new book coming out today, too, called Thrive, right? The third metric of wisdom and well-being that is, you know, kind of taking Steinem and kind of taking it into the next chapter. There are none of these people, and there is not that class conversation, much less the classroom at HBS. There is no Hannah Rosen at The Atlantic writing about the fact that women now far outnumber men in college attainment, high school attainment, college attainment, and postgraduate attainment. None of that existed, anything was even on the horizon,
right,
in 1963 when Betty Friedan published what we consider fired the first salvo of first wave feminism, The Feminine Mystique, right? Aimed, by the way, at wealthy, kind of upper middle class housewives, very different than Steinem's audience. So all of that was then, and this is now, as the old monkey song goes, and things be very different. So
yeah,
that's one of the reasons we don't have Gloria Steinem, right? And in some very rough, but not precise ways, why we don't have Martin Luther King. And that's not to say, don't we have work to do? We do, right? Not for women and blacks, but for all human beings trying to live a full and responsible and dignified and respectful life. We have lots of work to do. But man, oh man, we want to remember what she helped do and is still doing.
You know what I was saying to Jim before the show, when I think of people, and I said before, she changed my life when I heard her speak many, many years ago. But the second person I think who's had, in terms of impact on women's lives in the workplace, Anita Hill. When the Anita Hill hearings came, that changed everything. Your boss could no longer chase you around the desk and get away with it. You had some place to go complain to. To me, that she was revolutionary in that
sense.
How many
people do you think listening to the show know that this woman has lived in Boston for, what,
she's 20 years?
At Brandeis.
Right?
Almost nobody knows.
I just read a profile of her. I think it was in the New York Times. Mm. I believe she may, I'm not sure. She has come out of her life at Brandeis, right? And I believe either has a book or
a documentary.
Yeah. It's a documentary, yeah, coming out about her. But, you know, I have exactly the same reaction to her,
yeah,
right? Because she broke another tectonic plate, which is said, smile and let them make passes at you.
Exactly.
And if you say no, get used to being demoted, right?
Exactly.
Well, you know what also
she broke that open.
And
she did. And I'm not, obviously, I didn't experience what you both have earlier in your lives. It was also on television. And
yes.
When you list the great television moments, you Watergate hearings. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm missing some. Obviously, seeing JFK shot, but the Anita Hill hearings,
when Clarence
so many
Thomas
powerful
wedding.
Liberal men were completely silenced, including the great Ted Kennedy, for obvious reasons.
The famous pubic hair on the Coke can.
Exactly.
Who could ever forget that moment?
Well, just this again, like Steinem right now, or just listen to the cadence of her voice on the two recordings she's played.
Great.
There's a solidity and confidence, right, and freedom in the way she speaks, and you could, and all
That's
of that
great.
Was true of the. If you go back and Google on YouTube her Anita Hill's testimony, all of that was right there in that congressional room, testimony room.
Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton: Exploring Leadership. Up next, behavioral economist Michael Norton joins us to talk about how rituals can help us with the grieving process. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Because the vast majority of funding for 89.7 is provided by listeners, this program is available for free to you, your family, your friends, and all of your neighbors near and far. Thanks so much.
We may think we're fair, but new research suggests otherwise. The hidden biases you don't know you have. I'm Kara Miller. That's this week on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and Harvard Extension School, offering professional certificates and part-time master's programs. Info session Wednesday, June 11th. Details and more information available at extension.harvard.edu. And Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, dedicated to defeating cancer, one person at a time in the clinic, one gene at a time in the laboratory. This special combination of care and research strives to offer patients the best possible outcome. Dana-Farber.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Today we're on tape replaying some of our favorite conversations. Among them is a discussion with behavioral economist Michael Norton. He's with the Harvard Business School, and some of his latest research focuses on how rituals can help us assimilate grief. We start the conversation with Marjorie asking Michael where he got the inspiration to pursue this topic.
So you went and read the book by the president of Harvard. It's Drew Faust. And you got inspired. Now, what was all that about, please?
So she wrote this fascinating book about the Civil War and about death and mourning in the Civil War. And one of the things that she noticed was that, especially in the South, there were these very elaborate grieving rituals, and they centered on clothing. And we know these. So you wear black for a while, and then you wear gray for a while, and then maybe you wear gray, but there's a little purple added to it, and then you can wear purple, and then finally you can go back to what you were wearing. And I thought it was so fascinating because if you think about, am I over this loss that happened to me? We think about, you know, our emotional state and all these things, but one way you could think about it is you could look down at yourself and say, oh, I'm wearing gray. I guess I'm feeling a little bit better. Or look, I've got purple on. I guess I'm getting over it. There was this strange idea that these rituals that we engage in, really, although they seem a little bit odd and random, they might actually really help us get over these losses.
And so, when you mention ritual, what most people listening, and I know what I thought when I started reading about your research was, oh, you're talking about these grand public rituals, the things that are these collective expressions of grief and memory and that sort of thing. But that's not really what you're talking about, correct?
That's right. So when we ask people, you know, if someone you loved passed away, what kind of ritual did you do? People will say, yes, there was a funeral, but that's usually not what they mean when we ask them if they did a ritual. It's often something very private and personal that they did, even without anybody else knowing, to honor that person when they're gone. And those are the things that seem to really help them feel better about it.
Give us a couple of examples. There's some amazing ones in your research.
I think so. When we read these, you know, we just asked a lot of people to describe rituals, and some of them are just heartbreaking, and you can see how emotionally powerful they are. So the most poignant one to me was a woman, an older woman whose husband had passed away. And she told us that every Saturday, the way he used to do, she would wash his car in the way that he did. And again, it seems the car is clean, nobody's driving it, but you can clearly see how meaningful and important it is to her in remembering him.
Well, you know, you also talked about the other sort of grief experiences people have, like when the love of their life dumps them. And you talked about what people do in those kind of situations. Give us a couple of those examples. I thought these were great.
These are, they're funny because they feel so familiar to so many people. So one younger woman who lost her boyfriend broke up with her. It seemed like it was maybe a messy breakup. She said that she went to the park where they met, where they first kissed, with all of the pictures of them. And then she tore the pictures up and burned them in the park where they met. And she said she even burned the ones that she looked really good in, which was the biggest sacrifice of all.
I love those.
And it works. It works theoretically.
Or the other one. Tell us about the person that wrote the letter.
Which one is that?
This is the person that wrote a letter about the breakup. Well, if you don't, I'll tell you if you've forgotten it. She wrote a letter expressing her feelings, never mailed it, and destroyed the letter. But and somehow destroying that letter helped her painful feelings go away. I thought that was brilliant.
We see so many people talking about destroying and burning and things like that, tearing things up, and you can see how it's you're so mad, you're so upset, you're so angry.
Yeah.
These physical actions somehow seem to do something for us and really help us.
And while we're talking to Michael Norton about these, I call them personal rituals that people engage in to help them cope with or deal with losses big and small. If you have personal rituals that you've used to deal with losses, again, they can be, I don't mean to suggest a breakup is insignificant, but from breakups to losing something, a possession that mattered to you, or losing a person that mattered to you, what ritual has helped get you through? Give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. What I found most weird about your research is that you brought hundreds of people essentially into a lab and created an artificial loss for them, if that's a fair way to describe it. There was actually a fairly small one. This thing about, well, someone here is going to win $200. Describe the experiment you set up and then what you did to, I guess, further replicate the notion that small rituals help people get through these times.
You know, we really wanted to do experiments with real losses, like breaking up and things like that. But it turns out that as scientists, we can't randomly assign people to end their relationships on a given day or not, because we get in a lot of trouble. It is too bad. A lot of us know people that we think should end their relationships, but we're not allowed. So we said, is there another kind of loss that clearly isn't as emotionally meaningful as those that we could simulate in the lab to get people to lose something? And what we did was we had 10 people come in at a time, and we said, one of you is going to win $200 today and get to leave and not have to fill out our boring surveys. And we had them write what they would do with the $200. So they're fantasizing about the $200. And then we literally
told, that they get more invested in it.
Exactly.
I mean that as a pun, so they can really feel the $200
was
the notion.
Okay. This is going to be the greatest day of my entire life with the $200. And then we for real pulled one person and said, you get the $200. We gave them the money and they left. And the other people were sitting there with this loss that they just experienced. Not like losing a loved one, but this, I could have had that and now it's gone.
Right.
And some of them, we asked them to perform a ritual. We said, like the person who wrote a ritual for herself, we said, draw how you're feeling, count to 10, sprinkle salt on it, tear it up in little pieces and throw it away. And some people, we don't let them do that. And then we asked them, how are you feeling about the loss? And oddly enough, the people who got to write how they're feeling and tear it up and throw it away actually feel a little bit better about not winning the money than people who just had to sit there and grieve for the money that they could have had.
It makes sense to me, but why does this work? Our number is 877-301-8970. Again, if you've created your own small ritual to deal with things as arguably insignificant as almost winning $200, then losing it or losing someone you love, share with us and share with Michael Norton what it is that's helped get you through. Why does it work? Why does the literal or figurative ripping up help people get through this kind of deal?
It seems to be the case that, and I think that this resonates with people who've experienced a loss, that one of the things that happens, of course, you feel sad and you're grieving, but you also feel a little bit out of control. You feel like something happened to you in the world that you weren't expecting, and now you feel, I don't have any control over anything. Someone passes away, someone breaks up with you unexpectedly. It seems to be that when you engage in these rituals, which are these kind of repeated controlled activities, they actually make you feel more in control in general again. You feel a little bit less like the world is doing all these bad things to me, and a little bit more like I can kind of move forward and I'm back in control.
I think it makes so much sense,
though. Me too.
And you see different. I mean, I think, do you go to camp, overnight camp, when you were little?
Yeah.
I mean, Jim has the distinction of being the most improved camper at his overnight camp 2 years in a row.
No, that was the embarrassing part. The second year in a row was the embarrassing part.
But camps are big on rituals. The campfire thing, the last night, and all that stuff. Do you remember those?
No.
You don't?
I remember nothing from those days.
Do you remember? I mean, it was very ritualized. I never went to camp, but my kids have told me about this, how much they love these first night, last night rituals.
Absolutely.
And that's not about a loss, but it's about signifying things. And
yeah, but see, the thing that Michael Norton is saying, and this is obviously he's the person dealing with the science, the control thing makes total sense.
Sense.
I mean, it's out of control. You couldn't do anything to get the $200. You couldn't keep your husband alive. You couldn't stop this woman from leaving you. And so essentially all things out of your control, which is the worst part of random loss, I guess. And Michael's shaking his head up and down. So far he's with me. And all of a sudden, in a small way that really doesn't fix anything in the grand scheme of things, you regain control. That's what it is, right? That's what it is.
That's right. And I'm also just agreeing because I still feel bad that you had a bad camp experience.
Bad, but what was bad, actually. It was Camp Onabar, which is Rabino backwards, in case you're interested where it was.
Most improved camper.
2 years in a row.
2 years in a row.
Okay, fine, Marjorie. 877-301-8970. We're looking for you to share with us, and Michael Norton, who knows what he's talking about whether or not small rituals, personal rituals, have helped you deal with grief, loss, large losses. And by the way, before we get to the calls, though, actually, we started by introducing you saying this is a time when there's a feeling of collective loss. I mean, whether you were close to one of the three people plus Sean Collier who died either at or after the marathon, or one of the people who suffered a grievous loss, even if you're not, if you're just a citizen of the earth or a greater Bostonian, would these things work to deal with what is going to be a decent amount of sadness, already is a decent amount of sadness, for people who are going to be reliving some of these things come April 15th and April 21st?
You know, we do see when these tragic events happen, it's so common that people will spontaneously create kind of a place where they'll put pictures and flowers,
yes,
and candles and things. We've seen it over and over again with celebrities and politicians and people who die unexpectedly. Usually unexpectedly is when we do these things, not when we expected it to happen. And again, it's this feeling of this huge thing happened to all of us and we all feel out of control, and people will spontaneously all engage in a ritual in some sense. Not only does it make them feel back in control, as we talked about, but it gives you the sense of social connection with other people, which is also very important for getting over grief.
Well, look what we just saw in Boston with the two firefighters that were killed in the fire 2 weeks ago. I mean, the firefighters have this incredibly ritualized thing that they go through, from lining up to escort the body into the ambulance, and the ambulance
from
as it
the
goes
building,
down
right,
the street,
yeah,
from the building to the end,
yeah,
and the certain flags that they use when they do that sort of thing, and the tradition of, you saw it in both the firefighter Lieutenant Ed Walsh and Michael Kennedy, with the one other firefighter in Walsh's case, his brother, carrying the single helmet down the street, and the lining. I mean, and firefighters, because I was out there covering the story for the Herald, were talking about, obviously, this helps them get through, even those that were close to the firefighters, this helps them get through it. And I hope it's some comfort to the families as well.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Now we're going to ask you to share your rituals with Michael and with us. Helen, you're in Westwood and you're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Well, I love you guys.
Thanks.
I really enjoy that you're on this station.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have two quick things. When I lived in New York, I was married. And when my husband left, I decided to take it out on the bed that he cheated in. And so I threw it out of the second story window. And it was a wonderful ritual. It made me feel a lot better.
Is that a true story or are you making that up?
The true story, it included a couple of margaritas and an old roommate, but it was a lot of fun.
And did it really?
That's great.
Did it really? Don't leave that example yet, Helen. Did it really help?
It really, really helped. And I do have one other little,
sure,
not little, another example. My mother passed away last year,
mm-hmm,
and she lived in South Wales. And the day after she passed away, I drove to the coffee shop that we had our last coffee together in, and it was very important.
That's
those
are both. Those are both great. And you know, that's one of the things you
Helen,
talked about, Michael,
call.
Was the spouse who continued to go to the same hairdresser or barber, whatever it was, the first Saturday of the month, because I forget if it was the husband or wife that preceded the other, but the spouse did it because they did that together as husband and wife for all those years, kept on doing that. I knew a guy, I told you this story,
yeah,
the guy that used to own Durkin Park. I knew him, I knew his kids. And he, even though he very quickly remarried, continued to buy a car because he was obviously owned Durgan Park. He had a lot of money, or a good amount of money anyway. He used to buy a car, a white car, a white Pontiac, every year for his dead wife for about like 8 years.
For his wife?
For his dead wife. And it would go from the dealership to their house. And then after a year, it would go from the house back to the dealership. It was bizarre. We all thought he was crazy, especially since he remarried. We wondered what the new wife thought about that. But anyway, he did it.
Yeah, we do see that sometimes people think that what people are doing is crazy because they think the way to get over a loss is to move on and kind of forget about it. And that's not usually very, trying to forget things is usually not a very successful strategy in life. And some of these actions that might seem as though they're unhealthy actually can really be helpful in honoring that person and remembering them and helping you feel a little bit better about the loss.
Now, if I had said to you before Helen Cole, I know this woman whose husband left her, and she decided the ritual she would perform was to take the bed that her husband cheated on her in and toss it out the second floor window and hopefully not hit somebody. I'm serious. Does that fit the research of Michael Norton? And what's the name of your colleague who did this with you, by the way?
Francesca Gino.
Francesca. Does it fit the research you're talking about? Is that a ritual of sorts?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's this. So we talked about destroying and burning and tearing up. Throwing out the window and destroying is this very, very ritualistic. In fact, in many cultures, when someone passes away, the first thing you do is open all the windows. There's something about things leaving and things coming in. Again, it seems a little odd, but it seems to help people that you're symbolically letting go of things, literally pushing them out the door.
And before we get back to these calls, Michael Norton, when we say they deal better with than those who don't do these rituals, what is better and what's not better? What's the manifestation of both of those things in people after a loss?
Yeah, so if you look at the of course, everyone feels extreme sadness and grief and pain, really, when they have one of these losses. And for most people over time, that starts to dissipate a little bit. But it takes a very, very long, as anyone knows who's lost someone.
Even if they do nothing,
okay. It's a very, very long time. Rituals seem to hasten that process in some sense. So it's not as though you do a ritual and you're over it the next day. But they seem to help people feel a little bit better, a little bit faster in some sense. And we see over and over again when people do them, that slope of that curve seems to be a little bit quicker.
Let's go to Katie in the car. What's your ritual, Katie?
Excuse me. So when my aunt passed away, my uncle was selling the house and moving stuff out. And he gave me a single wine glass that was theirs. And so it is the wine glass that I drink from, even though it doesn't match anything I have. And every time I drink from it, I think of both of them. When she passed away, he moved to a different country, so I don't see him often. And I think of both of them, and if anyone else touches that wine glass or tries to drink from it, they get in trouble. Because it's for me.
That's great.
To remember.
That is beautiful. Katie, thank you for sharing that.
Michael, do you have any rituals you want to tell us about? From maybe your high school girlfriend went to the prom with somebody else or anything? Do you have anything you'd like to confess here on WGBH radio?
Well, I had. So in a former life, I thought I was going to be a musician. It turns out you have to be talented to be a musician.
Most do, yeah.
But I actually used to write songs when I had that adolescent, angst of my life is horrible and everything bad is happening. And in fact, creating things is another way that people can deal with grief.
Yeah, that's a Taylor Swift thing, right?
What's that?
Well, she writes a song about every ex-boyfriend.
She's written a lot of songs, as we know.
By the way, there's
a Facebook post. We don't mention these enough. Sarah posted, I saved ribbon from a memory quilt my students made after we lost one of their classmates. Looking at it helps me remember him and how kind his friends were to each other in the aftermath. When you hear the prior caller in the wine glass, I mean, it's these little symbols, something that person either touched or something that brings that person's memory back or the coffee shop. I mean, this all makes just perfect sense.
I've told you this, and I wrote about it in the Boston Herald, so I'm not telling a tale out of school. One of the young men, Cedric Steele, was murdered probably about 10 years ago now in Roxbury, and I went down to talk to his mom. This was a few months after he had died, and I walked in the front door of the apartment, and I thought there was a guy standing there, and then I looked, and it wasn't a guy. She had in a glass case, this is a small apartment, she had put in a glass case, made it so it was like a person with the hat and his green Adidas running suit and his sneakers and a brush with his hair. And it was all in this glass case. And, you know, it was, and I had gotten kind of friendly with it. I said, this, you know, this is, I thought, Natasha, this is a little weird. And she talked about how much it helped her because it was like her kid's outfit without her kid in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, we do see it's interesting because rituals we've shown can be quite helpful in dealing with grief, but I don't know her situation. But of course, you can do too much of them in some sense, and then it can get in the way of recovery. So
yeah.
Obsessive compulsive disorder is too many rituals where it interferes with your life. So we have been thinking about this. What is the right level of ritual that helps you and doesn't keep you from reaching out to other people or
well, what is the right ritual? And is it, where's the line? I know that it's pretty hard to describe. I
know
you
know
it when you see it.
Or
you don't
know. I
know
what
is it?
Well, we know, we're not going to mention this name, a person who her boyfriend left her. And when her boyfriend went on vacation, she went down to his house with a hose and put it through the front door, through the mail slot.
Well, actually, that story was in the Washington Post. She's a very famous conservative commentator.
When he came home,
yes,
it was like 6 feet underwater. I would say that's going too far.
Would that be a ritual? She said she felt better at the end of that. Is that?
I think if there's jail time on the other end, you've gone too far.
You know, before I get back to the calls, Michael Norton, who has done this research on small, can I call them small rituals or rituals, personal rituals that help people deal with loss of all different kinds, great loss and loss that's more personal, maybe smaller than that. Did shrinks know what your research, one time I called them shrinks on the air and people got all upset about it, but it's what I call them lovingly. Do shrinks, did they understand what you learn from your research, meaning when a shrink typically sits with someone who suffered a loss, have they through the ages said things like your research suggests, find some small, personal, meaningful way, use that same wine glass, go back to the coffee shop, wash the car. Have they been saying this or is this like a revelation?
I think that it's been observed so often that we do see that for, you know, thousands of years people have been doing this. And yes, there are actually organizations that try to help people with this. So we looked, for example, there's an organization that tries to, when children lose a parent, one of the things they do is they find out something special the child did with their parent, and they recreate it for them every year. And it could be on the holiday, but it could be a random thing. You know, we used to go to this ice cream shop and do this specific thing. They have this intuition that doesn't hurt the kid from getting over it. It actually helps them honor their parent when they're gone. And what we've really been trying to do is just show some evidence that it really does work and why it seems to work.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Michael Norton, a behavioral economist at Harvard Business School, about rituals that help people get over losing a loved one or getting dumped by their boyfriend or girlfriend, other things that hurt your feelings very badly. Jonathan from Newton. What do you think, Jonathan?
Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Marjorie and Jim. It's Jonathan Soroff, and I'm on my way to my shrink's office.
Jonathan Soroff from The Improper.
Jonathan,
hey, Jonathan.
Hi.
What's
How
up?
Are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
I have a couple of things to say. One is that, yeah, I think small rituals are extremely important. I have friends who have lost parents whose parents requested that there be absolutely no kind of funeral or memorial or anything, and they've had a harder time getting over it. Whereas when my dad died, there was an enormous, you know, there were three funerals. We flew him to Israel. We buried him in Israel. There were memorial services here. With my mother, you know, I always have fresh flowers in the house because I don't consider it a luxury. I consider it a way of commemorating my mother and her memory. You know, I go to her grave on Mother's Day, her birthday, you know, the day that she died, and I put flowers on her grave. And those things, if you look at Judaism, the stages of the path for grieving, there's certain things you do in the first day, certain things you do in the first week, certain things you do in the first month, 6 months, year. And those have really, according to most psychiatrists I know, have been proven to really help people get through the process of grieving.
Hey, Jonathan Soroff, before you go away, the flower thing you say to remember your mother, is that because certain flowers mattered a lot to her? She always liked fresh
Absolutely.
Flowers in the house. Is that what it was?
Absolutely.
Now, Jonathan, I think you should ask your shrink when you get into your appointment whether he agrees with your analysis.
That's very sexist of you, Marjorie. It's a woman.
Oh, what did I say?
That it was sexist of you.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
I will.
I shouldn't have called her shrink either. I was supposed to say psychiatrist.
Well, he did. I did.
My nickname for her is Shrinky Dick. So.
Hey, Jonathan Soroff.
Jonathan,
we love
you.
The Improper, and thanks so much for your phone call. I mean, that flower thing is perfect, is it not? I mean, that really, that's perfect.
Yeah, and we often see people using flowers as a way, you know, at funerals, of course, there's all these flowers. Yeah. And you say, why did we buy all these flowers? For these exact reasons, it seems to help people feel better.
But as we were saying before, you've talked a lot about private rituals, you know, the cutting up the photographs and stuff like that. But the public rituals, the funerals, they do serve a purpose because people do get together and they tell stories. And, you know, I remember interviewing a funeral director once about thinking, why do people want to have an open casket? And he said, because some people, particularly if they're close to the person that died, really need to see the body. And I never got that.
Nor do I.
But that's what he said. And I've heard people say that, that they want to see the person. They want to see him.
There was a fascinating, heartbreaking study on parents who lost an infant. And some of them had chosen to hold the child again, and some of them had chosen not to. And they interviewed them later, and the biggest regret of parents was, and their reasoning was, I don't want to see him like that. You know, now that he's gone, the biggest regret of those parents was that they hadn't taken the opportunity to hold him again. It was a very painful thing, and they if they had it to do over again, they wish they could have done that one more time.
Is there a book coming on this, by the way, or no? A
couple years.
There is one? You want a little advice from me?
Sure.
The graphic on the cover should be the woman who called who threw the bed out of the second floor window of her cheating husband.
I think that's an image.
Was that her name?
I think it was Mary. Good for Mary. I thought that was a great move on or Helen's part, whoever it was. Let's try to sneak in a couple more calls here. Amanda from Brockton. What do you think, Amanda?
Hi, Amanda.
Hi. Thanks for the conversation. I just had a couple of thoughts. The first is when people are feeling this loss, it's so painful, they don't know what to do with themselves, and I think giving them something to write down and tear up, it almost like you can pull that feeling out of yourself, look at it, visualize it, and then do something with it that you can't if it's just a feeling dwelling in you. And then the other thing I was thinking as you're having this conversation is just how if you are adding the story, if someone's passed or you've lost something and you are able to resolve it, then it allows you to move on and put some space. But we don't talk about death in our society, and we're all going to die, but we all of a sudden have to deal with it when someone passes. So I think it's really helpful for us to have a way to visualize it, make it concrete, and then do something with it so we get that sense of control.
You know, Amanda, the last point you made is a great point. Is this, I don't know what other, well, I do know what some other societies, that we are epic in terms of our inability to talk about or prepare for or deal with death, which may mean why these rituals are even more important than they might be in other societies. Does that make sense to you, Michael Norton, or no?
It does make sense, and I think that's also why these communal, you know, funerals are important, because they do provide a space where it is okay, at least for that day, to talk about death and talk about how you're feeling. The problem is the next day you're not supposed to anymore, and that's probably not the healthiest way to keep healing.
Yeah, I think it's always a bad move when you tell someone to get over it.
Yeah.
Or snap out of it. That's not the way to go.
Let's go to Ronnie and Wellesley. You're on with Michael Norton. We're talking about rituals that help people get through losses, large and small. Hey, Ronnie.
Hello. This is a great topic. I could give you a whole bunch of examples, but I'll start with one. My mother died about 6 years ago, and the two things that I remember from her funeral was she was a member of the Catholic Daughters in her church, so as the coffin was being wheeled up the aisle at the end of the service, all the Catholic Daughters were lined on either side of the aisle. I got to tell you, 6 years later, it still gives me chills to think of that. It was quite beautiful. And the other thing was, she died, her funeral was a few days after Easter. So the church was filled with Easter lilies, but, you know, it just happened to be there. So every year around the anniversary of her death, I buy an Easter lily to remember her.
Ronnie, what are the Catholic Daughters?
I'm not sure. It's a group that, I'm not sure what they do, but it's a group that I think it exists in any, probably mostly Catholic churches, but she was a member of that.
Ronnie,
but,
I'm sorry.
By the same token, my father died 20 years ago at the end of May. So every year, and he was a big, he had a wonderful vegetable garden. So every year I buy a tomato plant at the end of May in his honor.
This is amazing, actually. Ronnie, thank you for the call. You didn't need to waste all your money and time on this research. You just could have listened to callers to her.
Exactly.
Michael, this is really fascinating. Thanks
it
for sharing.
It is fascinating.
With us,
I love that. I'm sorry things you didn't work out as a musician. What was your instrument?
Guitar.
You look it.
So you were going to.
You do. You really do look.
You're going to be a rock star. It didn't quite happen that way, though, right?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, winding up at the Harvard Business School is not exactly a bad second outcome. Michael Norton is a behavioral economist at Harvard Business School and the co-author of a terrific book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Always great to talk to you, Michael. Up next, we talk to the man who holds the keys to one of the most exclusive portals in the world. That would be entry to the New Yorker by way of cartoons. Even the caption contest is an exclusive, very exclusive club. Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor of the New Yorker, and he joins us to talk about his new book. Stay tuned on 89.7 WGBH.
A lifetime ago, living and dying on the beaches at Normandy.
Every man that came through that machine gun fire and landed on Omaha Beach, every man was a hero.
June 6, 1944, forever known as D-Day. And as the men who lived it slowly passed from the scene, the efforts to preserve the oral history left behind. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH Radio exists because of you. And Triumph Modular, offering leased and permanent modular buildings. Triumph Modular's manufactured buildings are used for schools and commercial use, including office space, healthcare, and more. Triumph, redefining modular. TriumphModular.com. And Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's spring event in Natick or at DoverRug.com.
This is Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're rebroadcasting some of our favorite conversations. Earlier this year, Bob Mankoff, the cartoon editor of The New Yorker, he dropped by to talk about his new memoir. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is a man who has mastered pointillism, a man who has the authority to turn down literary bravados like Norman Mailer and David Mamet, a man whose alter ego has had face-to-face encounter with the Grim Reaper. We're talking, of course, about the cartoon editor of The New Yorker. That would be Bob Mankoff. Bob's latest book, which is spectacular, is called How About Never Is Never Good For You, My Life in Cartoons. And by the way, in addition to being here, you can catch him tonight at the Great Harvard Bookstore at 6 p.m. Bob, it's a pleasure to meet you.
I am really, really happy to be here, and I know when the Grim Reaper finally comes for me. I'm gonna say, how about never is never good for you? And I have that in the book. He's gonna say, yeah, cute, let's go.
I think I've seen that before.
Yeah, that's
I think
in the book. In the book.
Well, you know, I spent probably the most enjoyable 2 hours I've spent in weeks last night at my kitchen table. I've got the book. I've got the on my computer, the 74 favorite
slideshow.
Yeah.
And I'm going through. I am laughing hysterically. They are wonderful. And I'm thinking to myself, this man has got the best job in the world. But of course, that's what you said in the first line of the first page of the book that
best
you
two jobs
that you wrote. Well, why two jobs? Explain.
Well,
to people.
I'm also a cartoonist for the matter.
You're also a cartoonist.
Now that brings up the, of course, the issue of conflict because I'm the guy who I draw cartoons and I help the magazine select cartoons. I started the Cartoon Bank, which licenses the cartoons and. I'm happy you didn't have, like, a professor of ethics on before because they'd say, well, is there a conflict of interest here? And there is, and I just want you to know that I've appointed a blue ribbon committee, which I'm heading.
Okay.
I think I'm going to be okay. But, anyway, they all good. I can't complain, but I do.
Like everybody else.
Yeah, I guess. Well, because one of the things you've got to worry about, of course, well, we'll get to that in a second. I was interrupting
you. I am really...
Before we get to how you turn people down all the time.
This is like a tennis match here. I just want to tell people who are listening to the show because there are two Egans here, and one of them talks, and then I go list, and then I go right, and then they do like a little fake where one starts
she just
to talk and then
comes out. Yeah,
so now I have whiplash, but I'm going to try to do that.
It's his turn.
You know, I'm so glad that when I heard about your book, and I hadn't seen it, I'm so glad you put that cartoon on. Because, yeah. I mean, it is. It's, what was it, the early 90s you did the
93,
thing? 93. And everybody's seen this. No Thursday. Guy talking on the phone and is always, no, Thursday's out. How about never? It's never good for you. But I say to you, I hope you take this in the right way. Jonathan Gruber is sitting in your chair about, what, 2 weeks ago? And Gruber is the guy who was the genius behind Mitt Romney Care in Massachusetts and Obamacare. And we said, so what's it like to be like the guy between the greatest social something of the century?
Yeah.
He said, my little 10-year-old said to me a couple of months ago, hey, Dad, how does it feel to know that the greatest thing you're ever going to do in your life, you already did? Do you say to yourself, you've done, what, 1,000 cartoons in New Yorker?
Yeah, yeah.
So many of them are, and people.
Yeah, and I know what's going to be in my obituary.
It is what? This.
Yeah,
this is
is
what's going to be. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, well, there are worse things than being that than having done a great cartoon, being in the Yale Book of Quotations right next to that other great humorous Mao Zedong. people will remember me for that. But on the other hand, I've done these other cartoons actually I like much more. But you know, that's the way it is. You don't get to decide.
What's your this is horrible to ask, but yep. I know you expected it. What's your favorite of yours?
I like the cartoons I've done with. That's a cartoon that everybody resonates to because they identify it. Mm-hmm. It's at the heart of humor, which is conflict. The things we have to do, but the things we'd actually like to do. It works because it's both, the syntax is polite, but the message is rude. So it's got exactly that. But for me, my cartoons that speak more to, I guess, philosophical issues, like I did a cartoon once, it's called What Lemmings Believe, and it has the lemmings going up. And to me, that's about religion, about belief. In other words, it means something more than this thing that we identify with. Or another cartoon I did. My cartoons tend to be, the ones I like of mine are sort of social and cerebral. So there's three fish, and there's a little fish thinking, there's no justice in the world. The middle fish is thinking, there's some justice in the world. And the big fish is thinking, the world is just.
Yeah, but you say cerebral.
With his mouth wide open, he's about to eat them both.
Yeah.
I am so less cerebral than you. Because I would say one of my favorites of yours, which I think I'm pretty sure is almost in the book, is the guy's looking in the microwave. What does he say? No, I don't want to play chess. I just want you to eat my lasagna. Yeah.
Well, and that's right after Kasparov lost to Deep Blue.
Is that so?
Yeah, that was topical in its own way. And I like that. You know, here's the thing about the New Yorker humor and humor in general. It's not one thing. If you were to ask not just my cartoons, anybody, what are your five favorite cartoons? Could be the New Yorker, why not, and everything. You're not going to get agreement. Everyone's going to pick five different ones. And that's changed now because of the internet. Because of the internet, when people know what other people like, know what are favorites, whether it's music or whatever, you tend to get that type of consensus. But
really?
Yeah. Well, that's like why music or books become very popular. Everyone starts to agree because they see that their friends like
it. Oh, yeah.
But before that, let's say, I don't know, 1964, you ask someone, hey, what's your favorite song or whatever, you're going to get much more diversity now than when, you know, people know whatever else likes.
I want to mention one of your other favorite cartoons where the guy's got the knife and fork. You know, he's diving into the food, and it's called Macho Vegetarianism.
you forgot the punchline. The steak is saying moo.
That's right.
That's the one. The macho vegetarian, right there. I think he's trying to eat a cactus.
Love a guy who laughs at his own cartoons. But let's talk about your life prior to 1,000 cartoons.
Sorry,
in the New Yorker.
No press. I'm sorry. That's all
the editor. Okay, so let's talk about Little Bobby Mankoff.
Little Bobby Mankoff.
Virtually everybody I know would love to be a cartoonist, right, and published in the New Yorker. What's the deal? What made you from Little Bobby Mankoff to the failed cartoonist to the wildly successful cartoonist to the cartoon editor? What was Little Bobby Mankoff like? What was that like?
Well, a lot of that is luck. but the other part is, you know, I talk about growing up, my parents being Jewish in the 50s, being influenced by that whole culture. You know, I've said, you know, in 1980, 80% of the people in comedy in the United States were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a culture which comes out of Eastern Europe, it's a culture that, it's a coping culture that is using humor constantly, has to. Originally because of the conflict of assimilationist Jews, Hasidic Jews, Orthodox Jews in Eastern Europe, and where I almost used a bad word, where the Gentiles, you know, had weapons and killed each other over, like, minor disputes. The Jews' weapons, they didn't have armies, was words and wit and humor. So I grew up in a culture, and first of all, I said my mother spoke fluent Yiddish. Yiddish is like the language of both love and insult. So right there you have, you know, my mother called me a Kleinehund, little dog, Grosser Pferd, big horse, and Nervosa Cholera. Cholera means cholera. She called me a nervous plague. So I grew up in this culture where if you grew up in Jewish culture, but other cultures like that too. I just don't think it's completely as intense as it is in Jewish culture, where the humor is directed outward and inward.
Speaking of Speaking of humor, did I read somewhere, I don't know if it was in the book or in a review, you looked like Jerry Lewis when you were a kid? Was that right?
I looked like Jerry Lewis
now.
As a kid.
So you were
like,
huge in France or
like
something?
I look, and there was a 60 Minutes episode where it has these home movies of me doing the Jerry Lewis imitation. And when I saw Jerry Lewis, I was a skinny kid. I sort of looked like him. I went to Brown's Hotel, the Borscht Belt. This is where I saw
I worked at Grossinger,
okay,
so believe
you know,
me, I know this.
So
yes.
You know that whole thing. So one of the first things you do as a kid is you mimic. You imitate, you mug, you make funny faces, you know, so I did all that. And so part of this was this culture I was growing up in, and I don't know where it is. Everybody finds a card they play well. Maybe it's the fifth grade or the sixth grade where I sort of get the idea I'm funny, and it gets me attention. And it's also, elementary school, it's a pretty harsh environment in a way.
Yes.
You know, it's a bullying environment. It's an environment where you stand up for yourself. And one of the ways you stand up for yourself is by being funny, nasty funny. That you know, if somebody says something to you, you're going to say something back. And to use like the sort of Yiddish or Yiddish transliteration of my mother would say, he has a mouth on him.
My grandmother would say the same about me. By the way, we're talking to Bob Mankoff. His book, which is spectacular, is called How About Never Is Never Good For You, My Life in Cartoons. He's the cartoon editor of The New Yorker. And by the way, in the book, in addition to great text he's written, even though I did go right to the cartoons like most of us do, we go to The New Yorker, cartoons from all of the greats from The New Yorker.
So you realize you're funny in fifth or sixth grade. So how do you get from being funny, which lots of kids are in fifth or sixth grade, to doing these cartoons?
Well, I could draw, too, and I read comics. So right there you have, you know, if you're just funny by yourself, it's not like someone's coming up to you with a contract to do stuff. But if you're drawing, and I talk in the book just the initial manipulations, mashing up Donald Duck and Bugs Bunny, just fooling around. So drawing itself is a creative act. So it's an automatic mashup. And, of course, comic books were comic books. I mean, they weren't all funny, but right there. So by osmosis, you understood, well, this is something. I can be getting laughs and sort of more permanent laughs. But I'm drawing something. And then you draw something, people pass it around. People look at it. It's not as ephemeral as a wisecrack, you know, in class. Although, I talk about it in book. And, you know, one of the things I talk about is the power of humor on many, many different levels. I mean, one of it is coping, but one of it is power itself. And that I tell about this anecdote when I was at Syracuse University, bad student, never went to classes except the first class and the last class I would go to. You know, where I find out what the textbook is and take various performance-enhancing drugs, stay up all night. So I went to the sociology class. I come in late, and everyone's scribbling on their blue books. And the teacher comes up to me, hovers over me, and says, "Who the hell are you?" I wait a beat. I look it up and says, "You know, I could very well ask you the same question." So one of the great lines, everybody laughs. So that transformation from being the bad kid that is going to flunk, the teacher, you know, pulling you on the carpet, to all of a sudden you're, maybe it's only temporary, but you're on top.
How many cartoons did you submit to The New Yorker before one was accepted?
2,000.
No, is that true?
Yes.
2,000. What did it feel like when they finally said yes?
2,000.
This is what it feels like, and you're going to have to bleep it out, okay? But I'm going to say the whole thing. But you can't bleep it out, right?
Kind of. Can we bleep
it out? We can't,
out?
So you have to say bleep. You got to say bleep, unfortunately, or something.
Holy effing S.
Which
I
is what I would have said.
I sold an effing...
Wait a minute. Hold on. 2,000 over how much time?
From 74 to 77.
So that's 3 years. That's a lot of cartoons.
There's a lot of cartoons, but people don't realize how many cartoons cartoonists do. I was, when I got out of graduate school, all of the story, part of the book, I was doing 20 or 30 cartoons a week. I was selling to other magazines. But I was doing, you know, I hadn't focused yet on what it is I did. You know, when I talk about what we want at The New Yorker, I said, we're not looking for cartoons, we're looking for cartoonists.
Yeah.
A cartoonist is not someone who has a random
voice.
Everything. So I had assimilated what cartoons were, but I hadn't really honed in on what I did.
I want to talk about the acceptance and rejection. Has anyone ever sent in a cartoon and sends a letter along, like begging, saying to you, "I am begging you, Mr. Mankoff, to print this. This is all I care about. This could change my life." They ever do that or they don't
do
that?
You know what I always say? A letter with a 20 It's so much more effective than just a letter.
Fine. How'd you turn down Norman Mailer? How does anyone say no to Norman? How'd you turn down Norman Mailer?
If you saw the cartoons, you know how to say no.
Did he think they were good enough to be in
Norman,
there?
Norman came in. He was a very elderly man. He came in on crutches and he's a nice guy and everything. He showed me these drawings, which were not really cartoons. They were sort of scribbles of faces with things that he had written under them. He later published them along with poems in a book called Modest Gifts, which was very aptly titled. And what I said to him, I actually did say to him, this is like part of my snotty Queens background, I said, Norman, even if these were good, we wouldn't possibly publish them. Why? Because, okay, cartoonists get well known because of the cartoons they do, like Roz Chast. But it's because of what they've done as a cartoonist. Everyone would just be looking at this saying, this is a drawing or a cartoon by Norman Mailer. And while there are exceptions in the New Yorker, going back to William Steig and Peter Arnold and Charles Addon, for the most part, you know them as New Yorker cartoons. You don't really know the people. And you know their humor, you know their style, mm-hmm. and I think that's great, because it's much more of an honest game where the cartoon really has to pull its own weight. So the cartoons were lousy, and we wouldn't have wanted those.
One more celebrity, David Mamet. Tell about the back and forth between you and him.
Well, David Mamet, who when I became cartoon editor, he sent me a note saying, congratulations on becoming cartoon editor. This is back in 1997. I've taken the liberty of sending you a batch of cartoons. I wrote him back a note saying, thank you very much. I've taken the liberty of sending you a play.
Good, because everybody thinks they can do it, right?
Everybody thinks they can do it, or they can do it on their lunch hour and everything. And humor is very, very widely dispersed. You guys are funny. Professor Norton was funny. Everybody actually is funny. It's different than being funny for money, paying the rent,
right?
And week after week, turning it out. Because when you're turning it out, it's a profession, and anybody who writes jokes doesn't laugh at the jokes. They're evaluating the joke and judging it. So it's a different
So there are probably a few people who are listening to us now, though, who think that they could be a cartoonist at the New Yorker. So do you have any, are there any tips? Are there any things that people should just keep doing it to get up to 2,000 cartoons like you?
Here are the tips. Listen carefully.
I'm listening.
I'm only going to say this once.
Okay.
Although it will be rebroadcast over and over.
Yes, it will.
No, okay. First of all, it's a process to become a cartoonist. If you have one idea, don't send it in. That's what I call like idea rapture. You've never had an idea before, and now you're so thrilled with it. Okay, you don't have to do 2,000 cartoons, but young cartoonists say, well, how many cartoons should I do every week? And I say, well, do 10. They say, well, why 10? And I say, because 9 out of 10 things in life don't work out. Nine out of ten ideas you have for shows. 9 out of 10 things you do. If you're in a profession, you know that you get to good material by bad ideas. That if you're waiting for good ideas, so you have to start. So you have to do a lot of stuff. You have to then, you know, you have to. It's part of the creativity domain itself. You have to immerse yourself in this domain. Know what cartoons are. Read the complete cartoons of the New Yorker, my books, other cartoons, whatever. You know what I mean? Okay, maybe you're the absolute genius who never had to be exposed to any of the material. That's probably not the case. So in other words, immerse yourself in this field. See what's actually been done. Then start doing it yourself. Originally, you'll copy stuff. Nothing wrong with that. You'll imitate. That's where most of the stuff stops. Then you'll try to find your voice. Then when you start submitting stuff and it's rejected, if you come to me on Tuesdays, because Tuesdays it's open. Tuesdays open call at the New Yorker. Anybody who doesn't have explosives strapped around their waist can come in and see me.
They
you know
can?
What I mean? That's right.
Are
anybody.
You swamped?
Well, there's 30 or 40 people who come in. Most people are shy. Most people don't want to find out. They want to live in the world. These are great and everything. But so you just have to make an appointment with me. Anyone, you can find out how to do that. That's easy enough. Come in and see me. I'll give you my honest opinion. And I'm actually a pretty nice guy. If I see any talent at all, I'll say, yeah. If I don't see anything, I'm going to say, I'm sorry, I don't see anything. People ask, is the New Yorker open? We're absolutely open. Every year we introduce new cartoonists. Every single year there are new cartoonists in the magazine, just like every single year new people play for the Red Sox and the Yankees.
So I'll see you Tuesday then, Bob.
Absolutely.
Tuesday afternoon. That's right. I'll be in New York.
I think George Bush is going to go in.
I won't say how about never.
Yeah. Okay. Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor of The New Yorker. His latest book is How About Never Is Never Good For You. When we come back, we're topping off the show with a conversation about food and wine inspired by the hit TV show Downton Abbey. Food writer Corby Kummer and wine guy Jonathan Alsop join us next for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, the never-ending crisis in the state medical examiner's office, how it is killing the living. If you missed it on the radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
Saturday, July 12th, it's the WGBH Fun Fest, packed with music, games, and all the ice cream you can eat. A family four-pack is yours for a gift of just $35. Online at WGBH.org/funfest.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Ferguson Bath Kitchen and Lighting Gallery, featuring products for your kitchen and bath, including Growy Agira bath faucets, inspired by hand crafting techniques. Locations at Ferguson.com. And Northeastern University, where researchers are mapping people's travel patterns to forecast pandemics, giving global health policy a new direction. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today we're replaying some of our favorite conversations. Among them is a discussion with food writer Corby Kummer and wine expert Jonathan Alsop about how to fill the void that so many of us were left with when the latest season of Downton Abbey wrapped up. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. So if you Google Downton Abbey withdrawal, you get over 150,000 results. The AARP suggests renting the movie Gosford Park. Glamour magazine suggests reading an 800-page book about a modern-day American heiress entitled Wicked Pleasures. The Reporter Times of Martinsville and Morgantown, Indiana. You read that, Marjorie, don't you?
Every day, Jim.
Suggests having a spot of English-style tea. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about how we can take the bite out of Downton Abbey withdrawal by way of Downton Abbey-inspired wine and food are Jonathan Alsop, he's founder of the Boston Wine School, and Corby Kummer is the senior editor at The Atlantic. Listen to that, and an award-winning food writer. Gentlemen, it's great to see you both again.
Great to be here.
Yeah, Jonathan's over there. He's uncorking the wine that actually says Downton Abbey. I thought this was a joke, but
it
does.
In great big letters.
Yeah, it absolutely does. So I guess the thing is, how do we know that this is a Downton Abbey wine or Downton Abbey food? I mean, did they put the menus at the end of with the credits at the end of the show?
You start because
Jonathan, you start. Corby's directing the conversation.
I'm so scorching back on this. Back.
So, how do we know that this is? How do we know that this is historically authentic?
Yes, exactly.
Well, we know. That's a really good question.
That's why I'm here. Ask those penetrating questions.
Well, so these wines that we're about to taste here, these are, of course, modern wines, but they are a white Bordeaux,
yep,
and a red Bordeaux. And Bordeaux is a place in France and also a type of wine, typically a blend of, in the case of the red wine, mostly Merlot, then Cabernet,
yep,
and then a little bit of Malbec. And then the white wine is a blend of two white grapes, Muscadel and Semillon. And these are really traditional, old school wines. These wines and port are exactly, and maybe a little bit of Burgundy, German Rieslings. These were super popular in this time period. And, you know, Red Bordeaux in some ways continues to be, you know, the king of the world's wine
regions. Because
they
would never drink California wine. Was there even California wine back in the 1920s and 1917 and 18?
Yes. There was a ton of it. Yeah, it was a ton of it. And it would never have got over to Europe.
Your answer to her question, Jonathan, I assume, is they either were drinking it or they should have been drinking it. Is that where you're going? Now, Corby Cummer, you started this conversation by shifting the guest burden to your friend here by saying you had a scorching analysis. What are you scorching about?
Oh, that I was given as prep for this show the unofficial Downton Abbey cookbook from Lady Mary's crab canapés to Mrs. Patmore's Christmas pudding, more than 150 recipes from upstairs and downstairs. I'm not even going to mention the author's name because it is one of the most bogus exploitation attempts to rip off a successful show that I've ever seen. It has absolutely nothing to do with period food, which I'm
God, how I wish I had written it.
Which I'm very happy to talk about. But one thing that I was just peering at the wine label Jonathan brought in, Downton Abbey has a registered trademark on it and a picture of Highclere Castle on it, which means it probably has some kind of tie-in, meaning profit sharing with the show. This book says, this book is unofficial and unauthorized, not authorized, approved, licensed, or endorsed by Carnival Film and Television Limited, as I should say it shouldn't be.
Okay, fine. Because, okay. We know you don't like the book.
What was the period? Now, it started right in the teens, right? Downton Abbey started in like 1910 or 1915, before the war.
Yes.
And then started at the time of the Titanic, which is before the war.
1912, okay.
1912.
And then it continued on. Until we're in the post-war period.
We're in the early 20s.
Okay. So what do people eat at these la-di-da castles over there?
That we have the ability to make so that, we can deal with withdrawal, which is the reason you both are here.
So what they made and ate was food from Escoffier from the late 1800s. It was full of butter and cream, and it was extremely labor-intensive, and it was all French technique. So one of the authentic subplots, semi-authentic because everything's semi-authentic on Downton Abbey, is when the under footman or whatever he is, I think Alfred, tries to become a cook. And he tries out at the Ritz, which was indeed the domain of Auguste Escoffier, we think of as, Mr. French cuisine.
Yes.
He worked in London, and he made his reputation at the London Ritz. And he wrote a guidebook that is still to this day the repertoire of cuisine, the kind of thumb manual for every apprentice cook. They still read Escoffier. That was going on, and it was classic French food in those houses. That's all upstairs ate. Downstairs had, I think, really good food that we should be emulating as part of our Escoffier, as part of our Downton Abbey withdrawal, not the Escoffier food. Jonathan, say what your reaction was. You were telling me what you thought of when you read 80 unofficial recipes inspired by Downton Abbey online.
So first of all, I checked out the book Edwardian Cooking, 80 Recipes Inspired by Downton Abbey's Elegant Meals. And I just felt really, really lucky to have wine. that wine was part of the table was a real lifesaver. Is it possible to grow lactose intolerant just by reading a cookbook? Is this scientifically possible? Because I really feel like that happened to me while I was looking through.
So it was all cream cheese and stuff that would kill you. So they should all be dead midway through.
Wait a second. Marjorie is participating in this conversation like she agrees with you. Marjorie, what do you put in your mashed potatoes, Marjorie?
Well, I do.
What do you put in your mashed potatoes?
I do put heavy cream.
She puts heavy cream
and lots of butter.
Jim, how much? I mean, there's a difference here. I discovered a new food group,
which is
the stringy food group. Leek, pie, mutton pie.
I love mutton pie.
Steak and kidney.
Yeah, these are really good foods. Steak you're starting kidney, to beat up on. Watch
steak
it.
And kidney pie. Is the kidney really necessary?
I just like to ask.
Far too much negativity here. People, the whole concept again is people are going through Downton Abbey withdrawal. You're supposed to help them.
Okay.
So instead of disparaging the cookbook and all the recipes,
I have wine.
Watercress sandwiches. I mean, isn't that the classic high wasp sort of thing? they were high WASP, even though it was the 1920s.
So there are a couple
cucumber
of things,
sandwiches.
But we shouldn't be mimicking the upstairs anyway. We want to all mimic the downstairs.
Okay, let's stay downstairs.
We know our place, and that's where we all would have been anyway.
Lots of cabbage.
So tell us what we should be eating.
So go out and buy Dorinna Allen's books from Ballymaloe. Ballymaloe is an Irish country estate that a bunch of enterprising women starting in the post-war era, like the enterprising Lady Mary, brought back from the near-dead and tax collection death by starting a cooking school and a farm. And Ballymaloe is a sustainable paradise in Ireland that still teaches traditional British food. And Dorinna is a brilliant teacher. Her mother-in-law started the Ballymaloe cookbook. They all publish cookbooks. This is great British food. What does it rely on? What you would have had at Downton Abbey, which is meat and vegetables grown right there on the estate. Now, they would have been drowned in the butter that would have killed Jonathan and the cream upstairs. But there would have been less of it downstairs. It would have been more simply prepared. Yes, you can say it was overcooked. Some of it might have been stringy. But it also had very hearty, real flavor that we all die to have right now because it was as local as you can get. It is the way we are aspiring to eat, but with less cholesterol. It's excellent food, what you find in the Ballymaloe.
So it's essentially farm to table before farm to table.
Absolutely farm to table. Estate to table.
Would they shoot the animals right there on the estate at Downton Abbey?
Yeah, of course they would. They would shoot them and they would dress them right there.
Wow. Like what? Chickens? Turkeys?
Oh, like lamb for mutton.
Oh, lamb.
Which we both
pheasant.
Like.
Pheasant.
Yes, pheasant. Well, that's when they would, you know, they would stock their hunting scenes in Downton Abbey. They would stock them and they would flush them. And yes, they would all go with their partridge bags. And a lot of it would be killed and dressed for the noble table. Some of it would be so full of shot that it would be unusable and they wouldn't eat it. But that still goes on.
How about giraffe? No, actually, we're not talking about giraffe in light of what happened in another part of the world.
Right.
So give us one recipe, or at least the outlines. Let's start with mutton, because I could totally get into that. Mm-hmm. Give us a mutton kind of thing that people could do to relive the downstairs experience.
So if you can find aged lamb at Savinor's or one of the great butchers in Boston or Newton, you will be very lucky because it has a flavor unlike anything else. It really tastes like lamb. Lamb is now being essentially bred so that it tastes like a cross between ostrich and beef. You know, very bland, very nice, but, you know, timid and tepid. If you can find aged lamb, that's mutton. It's over a year, year and a half, I think. And what they would have done in the great houses is simply to roast it. It would have been a very simple roast, probably overcooked and well done. But you should cook it dark pink in the center.
What? The British are famous for overcooking their meat. What's that about?
Just taste and not thinking in terms of flavor, but thinking in terms of hygiene. So I brought in a history of food and drink in Britain from the Stone Age to the 19th century by C. Ann Wilson, who's an excellent historian. That and Mrs. Beeton, Beeton, which is a wonderful book of Victorian householdry. They started the whole sanitation and nutrition movement where everything had to be healthy and better for the home and you didn't want to bring any kind of danger. And also there's the idea of fear of good food. You know, as the French would define it, that means meat cooked rare. But as Jonathan is saying, where they really excelled and still excel is in their love of good French wine. And they have better collections and better cellars of French wine than lots of French people have.
Absolutely. I mean, the connection between Britain and, well, in the case of the wines we're tasting here, Bordeaux, and also Britain and port. You know, it was really the English and their love of this sweet, late harvest, super high alcohol dessert wine that really made port extremely famous.
Now, excuse me for just a second here, Jonathan Alsop from the wine school. What is the first name of the wine school?
Boston Wine School?
I've
had one sip of the Bordeaux. I'm out of order already. But this piece from Slate Magazine claims that the Chardonnay from Duck Dynasty indeed tastes better than the Downton Abbey Bordeaux Blanc. Could that possibly be true?
You know, they taste completely different, and you know, in the Downton Abbey, so different from the dark side of the moon red as well, the Pink Floyd red that this company also makes.
Okay.
Tastes the
good
company
to me.
The company that makes or that sells Downton Abbey here in the US, they also make other celebrity wines, a Grateful Red. I wasn't kidding about the Dark Side of the Moon Pink Floyd wine.
Yeah.
The Pink Floyd.
And you brought that into us once.
Yeah, we didn't.
It was good.
We didn't hate that.
No, we did not. This tastes fine to me, too.
Not hating it is not that much.
Yeah.
But I'm always nervous when you're here saying I like something. But, of course, you brought it, so one would assume that you like it, too.
Okay.
The red is actually, it's fabulous.
It's very tasty,
isn't it? I don't
know
anything about anything, but it's really, really good.
Yeah.
What's the price range for that?
$14.99.
Well, that's pretty
both
affordable
of these,
as
the red
well.
And the white. But, you know, this is a blend of three grapes that people love: Merlot, Cabernet, and Malbec.
Okay. We are talking about Downton Abbey withdrawal because season four wrapped up on Sunday. We're joined by Jonathan Alsop from the Boston Wine School and Corby Cummer from The Atlantic. You know, Corby, you mentioned before that in the real Downton Abbey, if there were a real Downton Abbey, the wealthier people would have been eating all the butter and the heavy foods, and downstairs it would have been a lighter fare. So how does that compare? I mean, obviously nobody wants to be eating cream and butter and heavy fat all the time because we don't want to die of heart attacks. But,
except for you.
Yeah, right. But I'm
wondering,
well, I do. I shouldn't do it.
But, everyone else in our nation.
Yeah. But how does it compare, the downstairs, upstairs cooking with what we do now? I assume we're much better now, aren't we? Or are we not?
Well, when you say better, we...
Healthier, more tasty.
But we're not really healthier because when they were loading it with butter and cream, what my main message about British food is, there is no better dairy in the world than Irish butter and cream. So and milk. Oh God, do I dream of the milk?
How about their clotted cream?
Well, of course.
Tell people what clotted cream
nothing
is.
Nothing like it. So clotted cream is slightly soured cream that's extremely thick. It's like the top of a cream bottle.
Yes.
And a top of unhomogenized milk
bottle.
And you
put it on scones.
Oh, it's the most fabulous thing in the world. So the dairy is fantastic. It was honest ingredients in food. And now there are all these kinds of additives and trans fats that they weren't having any of. The problem was that rich people ate it to excess, and fat was considered a sign of wealth. There was no opprobrium to being fat. Although, it's interesting to see how lean all the women are in the 1920s, because Chanel and others started popular, and the flapper look was a lean look.
Yes.
It was the first time that rich people were supposed to be really lean. Girdles started going out. We have Mrs. Patmore saying, if I'm going to be modernized at all, I wouldn't mind losing my corset. Because that's what fashionable women started to do in the 1920s.
I should know this. Are there restaurants that have, either here, New York, elsewhere, that have attempted to do what we're doing in mini fashion here, meaning that they are a period restaurant, whether it's for a week, a month, or permanently? Is there a restaurant that we have the food and wine of the 1920s and 30s?
There is such a charming restaurant in the South End that I hope is still doing well called Kitchen. It's right across from the great classic unparalleled Hammersley's Bistro.
And what's the concept?
Historical food.
Oh, really?
So they pick historical food from different periods. And when they first opened, they had this mushroom canapé under glass. So they had a big cloche, you know, like a bell, a glass bell. And they would bring it to your table and whisk off the bell. Why would they do this? This is still very much in fashion. So that you would be engulfed and intoxicated by the smell sherry sautéed mushrooms when they took it off. Speaking of pouring these fortified sweet wines, so that there are these fumes that engulf you and like give you a high. And that was one of the things that was very popular in this time. And now Von Gerichten in New York and other chefs, the whole idea, and Grant Achatz in Chicago would actually inject scented air into a pillow. They would serve a plate of food on this pillow that had little pinpricks, so it would slowly waft this air. Or they'll come with an atomizer.
I want all my food served like that from now
too.
On.
So this kind of sensory effect and 3D kind of effect still goes on, and it was popular in those times too. I hope Kitchen has thought of doing Edwardian food. They probably have.
You know, when I think of sort of Downton Abbey type deals. I think of going to high tea, like at the at the Four Seasons, which I used to do with my daughters, which is wonderful because they still do high tea in Great Britain even now.
Well, all right, I have to have the schoolmarm correction of what high tea means.
Okay,
high tea was for the working class and it meant meat.
Oh,
and it was the substitution for dinner. It was cheaper and it was earlier than dinner.
Okay,
so you would come home from the factory. And you would have tea that wasn't just the usual milk and sugar and tea, which became a working class substitute for actual nutrition. When sugar became really cheap in the 1880s, it became a way that the middle class, that the working class would eat and avoid having to eat richer food because sugar is sating. It's not particularly nutritious, but it actually takes the curb off your appetite. So high tea would include meat.
Did Corby put you in your
he
place?
He did. Sorry.
Yeah.
No,
everybody
low tea for you, lady.
Low tea.
Everybody thinks
in the basement,
high tea.
Tea.
Is fancy.
But underground.
High tea is the less fancy version. So the tea that we all long for at Brown's Hotel or the Ritz in London is sandwiches, is various small crustless sandwiches, and scones and clotted cream
scones
and fresh
and
strawberry
cream.
Preserves.
Oh, God, it's
and,
great.
And, by the way, cinnamon toast, which the Ritz used to have and is impossible to find now. So, you know, these are very easy things to make. And, yes, there's nothing more delicious. And tea sandwiches are still very easy for anyone to make. James Beard in America revived tea sandwiches, so you find lots of James.
Do tea sandwiches just mean sandwiches with the crust cut off, or are they something specific?
Often, or they have, for example, mayonnaise and smoked salmon and onions, or all these really good sandwiches.
Ooh.
that the new Nordic cuisine is now reviving in open face form, or they're rolled in parsley. You stamp it with a glass so that it's round. You roll it in butter and then parsley, so it has this pretty edge. That's what James Beard did. So all these things are, you know, ridiculous, but they're cute for mothers and their daughters to do.
I love it.
I'm excited for Lady Edith's boyfriend to come back from Germany with all kinds of new uses for sauerkraut. I think for next season, I'm really looking forward. Did I just give her a spoiler?
No, you didn't. Are you into Downton Abbey?
This is Jonathan also asking.
Yeah, I do watch it. And is it? And what I notice at the table when they're eating dinner is the table actually seems to me to be very bare.
Bare, right.
I mean, I know it's being served and plated bit by bit, but there's not this sort of overwhelming, you know, hey, I live in an abbey.
There never was.
I live in an abbey. Look at this giant amount of food on my table.
Before the 1870s or 80s, there was what was called French service, which had all of the food in the middle of the table. We now call it family style. So you could constantly reach for more food. But then service a la Russe, Russian service, came in. And that's what we're seeing, where you're served from the left, in from the left, out from the right. And if you didn't take enough the first time because you were delicate, you know, forget it. Maybe you would get second service. Not, but it's not that there was this huge excess of food. What there was many different courses, many more courses than we have today.
And they're all skinny in Downton Abbey, too. The women are all skinny, so they weren't living according to the story.
Yeah, it's also television. Not a story. It's actresses aren't going to be fat.
Yeah,
hey, Corby, are you aware that this book you disparage, the unofficial Downton Abbey cookbook, and you didn't want to mention the author, she is also responsible for the unofficial Hunger Games cookbook. Have you read that one?
Oh, it's one of my favorites.
This is true.
Thank you for bringing it up.
I smell sequel.
Okay,
we need... just shot squirrels in the Hunger Games.
I'm just reading what I'm reading. Okay, it's Jonathan Alsop, final wine tip for people suffering from Downton Abbey withdrawal. Give us a 30-second tip, if you would.
30-second tip is go and pick up some of these old school Downton Abbey style wines. Bordeaux, our idea of it is that it's expensive and it can be super expensive. There's some great $15, $20 red Bordeaux's that are good Tuesday night drinking.
This is amongst them. Now it's your turn, Corby, without disparaging the author.
Oh, no, I'm just going to mention great books. Dorinna Allen's Ballymaloe Irish Cookbooks and Jane Grigson's British Food, which is one of the most beautifully written books in this incredibly muscular, honest, fantastic prose that
will
make you want to learn everything about English food. Really.
I love the adjective muscular. Corby Kummer is an award-winning food writer and a senior editor at The Atlantic. Jonathan Alsop is the founder of the Boston Wine School. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker.